Welcome to Geburtsgeschichten Podcast. Welcome back if you are a regular listener, and a very warm welcome if you're joining me today for the very first time. From the title of the podcast, you have probably guessed already that this show is usually not in English. Geburtsgeschichten is German and means birth stories. And usually I interview women about their pregnancy, birth and postpartum on this show. But once in a while, I have special guests on who don't always speak English. And my guest today, even though she tells me she has a very long and successful streak of consecutive days of learning German on Duolingo. Her German is not good enough yet to be interviewed in German, so this interview today is in English. So my guest today is Jan Kammel, the founder of VBAC Facts. She is a well of knowledge and an absolute inspiration. She advocates for VBAC access and improved VBAC outcomes in the US, but also worldwide. And if you are interested in these kinds of conversations on certain topics surrounding birth, then do scroll back in my podcast feed. I recently had the wonderful Hermine Hayes-Klein on the show. She is an attorney and human rights activist who supports the rights of pregnant women and birthing people. And I also recently had Dr. Koen Durlo from the Netherlands on the show, who is a pioneer in maternal assisted C-sections. But for now, I'm going to hand the mic over to Jan Kammel and talk to her all things VBAC.
Geburtsgeschichten. Ich bin Thea Maillard. In diesem Podcast erzählen Frauen von ihrer Schwangerschaft, der Geburt und dem Wochenbett.
Welcome, Jan. I am so excited to have you as a guest on my podcast today.
I am so thrilled to be here.
Can you introduce yourself to my listeners? Who are you and what do you do?
Well, I'm Jan Kammel. I'm the founder and CEO of VBAC Facts, and our mission and our focus since 2007 has been to provide accurate and objective information on vaginal birth after cesarean and repeat cesarean to parents, professionals, policymakers, and the court, so all decisions can be informed, ethical, and just.
Oh, I just love how you say that, and I've been on your website so many times. I'm a huge fan of your work. And before we dive into all things VBAC, the first question I ask all of my guests is, what do you know about your own birth? How were you born into this world?
You know, that is such a great question. I don't know a whole lot about my birth. I do know that my mom went into spontaneous labor. I think there was a full moon that night, and she labored at the hospital with a friend and gave birth vaginally. And she always described birth to me as hard work, but not torturous. You know, that was her experience. So that was the framework and the foundation with which that I kind of perceived birth through. And as I think about it now, I think that really probably, unbeknownst to me, laid this foundation of this is something that I can do. And also, I was always very curious about what birth felt like, what that experience would be like. I'm a very physical person. I enjoy hiking and backpacking. I enjoy feeling my body work. So that was something that I was really looking forward to experiencing.
Yeah, and then your first birth didn't turn out as planned, which then led you into founding VBAC Facts. So do you want to just briefly talk about the birth of your own children?
So my first birth, I hired a hospital-based midwife in Southern California. At the time, there was a hospital in Laguna Beach that offered midwifery care, and they had floor-to-ceiling windows overlooking the Pacific Ocean. And I thought, what a fantastic place to give birth. So my plan was to birth there. And then throughout my pregnancy, my baby was in a variety of different positions. You know, no big deal. Babies move around. But then as I got closer and closer to term at 36 weeks or 37 weeks, trying to think when that was, I think 37 weeks, my baby was diagnosed as, I think at that point she was transverse. And so my midwife said, you know, it's okay. We can do an external cephalic version. We can see, we can try to turn her so that way she would be in a favorable position. Or she might even, you know, she moved around so much, she might have been a single footling breech at that point. Because I remember so distinctly, she had one head, she had her head under my right rib, one foot under my left rib, and then another foot hanging down into my pelvis. So I could feel her little skull underneath that rib. And it's like, I've got my hands there right now because I just remember so distinctly feeling her foot and her skull. And so was referred out to an obstetrician who performed an external cephalic version. It was not successful. And I left with this piece of paper with my scheduled C-section date for a week later. And I was really, really surprised, disappointed, a whole host of emotions as this like curiosity, this desire to experience a vaginal delivery and also to avoid major surgery was now reduced down to a surgical birth. And of course, I was grateful for the opportunity to give birth safely to my baby. But also, I mourned the fact that I needed to have this surgery, and I mourned the fact that I was now going to be recovering from surgery. And I also don't even think I was thinking at the moment, what did this birth mean for my subsequent births? And it was only after my baby was born with this very sympathetic and kind and compassionate OB, I will be forever grateful because after my C-section, he said, you know, there's no reason why you can't have a VBAC next time. And I'm so glad he planted that seed because I'm not sure what things are like in your country, but in the U.S., most people have a repeat cesarean. And this was back in 2004 when my daughter was born. And at that time, the VBAC rate in the U.S. was about 8%. So 92% of people had a repeat cesarean. So even in the midst of that culture, this wonderful OB said to me, there's no reason you can't have a VBAC. And I'm forever grateful because then I went out into the world and well-meaning friends and family would say, oh, well, this is so wonderful. You had a C-section. You could just have another one next time. And I said, oh, no. My OB assured me that VBAC was an option for me. And unbeknownst to me, that was really the seed of VBAC Facts was born right there, was me being out there educating the public on a very foundational concept, right? That VBAC was still an option. And so 3.5 years later, I had performed a variety of research, analysis, learned how to evaluate medical studies, learned what a p-value was, what a confidence interval was, learned how to evaluate abstracts, learned how to critically analyze research. So because there were so many questions I had, and as I was interacting with the public on social media, I was finding that a lot of people were expressing things as certitudes that weren't actually true. And so I had a particular joy in finding either research that either confirmed what they were saying or refuted what they were saying. I just loved that. So fast forward 3.5 years after my daughter was born, I had a wonderful VBAC with my son, spontaneous labor, 9 hours from start to finish. And he had his head was asynclitic. He had his hand up by his head, so he had a compound presentation. And I had a postpartum hemorrhage, which was managed by my midwife. I received Pitocin and Methogen and had a wonderful home birth and recovered well from not only that home birth, but also that postpartum hemorrhage, and had a completely different experience of postpartum with my VBAC in comparison to my C-section. I felt like me immediately, whereas with my C-section, it took me quite a long time for me to just really feel like I have found who I was again. So I came out of that birth feeling like there was nothing in this world I couldn't do. I uncovered a strength within myself that I wasn't quite sure ever existed. And I realized how many people are robbed of the opportunity to have this transformational experience that is supported by the evidence and national guidelines and around the world. And so I really wanted to ensure that parents had the opportunity to really make an informed choice. Because as I said, in the U.S., most are recommended to have a repeat C-section. Most do. And I just wanted parents to know, you know, if you want a VBAC, it is an evidence-based option. It is something that's supported by the national guidelines, the medical ethics, medical evidence, and you have the right to make this decision for yourself.
And that was then the start of VBAC Facts, which you founded in 2007. And could you just talk a little bit about what exactly you offer through VBAC Facts?
Yeah, so it really started with a course for parents that I had developed. Within 2 or 3 years of my son of being born, I had received many requests for me to speak around the country. I had bought the domain VBAC Facts 2 weeks after he was born, created the website, and just started sharing information on the website for people to learn more about VBAC. And then I started getting requests to speak, and so I developed a program, ultimately became a continuing education provider through the California Board of Registered Nursing, launched our professional membership where we have our signature training, The Truth About VBAC for Professionals, as well as a variety of other continuing education trainings on topics like continuous fetal monitoring during VBAC, vaginal birth after 2 cesareans, after 3 cesareans, single versus dual layer suturing, a variety of different topics. And we have over 25 contact hours available through that platform. I also speak across the country. That's one of my favorite things to do. And in fact, I shouldn't say across the country because I have spoken at international conferences and I love to do that. I love speaking to audiences of parents and professionals because there is so much misinformation about VBAC, and we have the opportunity to not only increase VBAC access, but also improve VBAC outcomes through really informed decision making and access to solid, accurate, transparent information. So we have that. So we have our courses for parents, courses for professionals. I speak around the world. And I also provide policy and legal consulting. So policy consulting looks like, most often it is surrounding the laws and rules that govern midwives in the U.S. because we don't have national midwife laws. Midwifery is governed by each individual state, and each state has different rules and laws that they adhere to. Often those rules and laws interfere with a midwife's ability to attend VBAC. And so we want to make sure that women and birthing people have access to VBAC in all settings, at home or in the hospital or in a birth center, because in the U.S., we have a lot of birth deserts, meaning that there are huge swaths of the country that do not have obstetrical providers, whether that is an obstetrician, a family medicine doctor, some other type of physician, or a midwife. And so women find that they have to travel long distances. We think it's best for women to have options, whether they want to travel 3 hours to a hospital or they want to give birth in their community. Risks and benefits, as always, with these decisions, but ultimately that decision should lie with them. And then also I do legal consulting, looking at supporting cases where VBAC is the center of the case. And typically that's revolving around either midwifery care or state rules and laws which govern VBAC access through Medicare, through state insurance plans, medical insurance plans. I love this work. It's very important. There aren't a lot of people out there talking about VBAC like I do. And I think it is really important in terms of a public health initiative to ensure that people have access to accurate information and are able to make their own informed decisions.
Absolutely. You started VBAC Facts nearly 20 years ago. What do you have seen has improved since then? And what has stayed the same, and are there areas that have gotten worse in terms of VBAC access and VBAC information?
Yeah. So when my daughter was born, like I said, there was an 8% VBAC rate, and now we're about 15% in the U.S. So like you said, 20 years ago, it has improved, but we still have a long way to go. And so we can look at that a couple different ways. We can look at that like, wow, it hasn't really grown that much, or wow, we still have a long way to go. I choose to celebrate the win and also keep on moving forward towards making sure that most people have access to VBAC. I am continually shocked that still now in 2026, there are women who are pregnant after a C-section and they go to their doctor and their doctor's like, great, when do you want to plan your next C-section? That is the beginning and the end of the informed consent conversation. So that's just one example of an area that we have a lot of work to do. We need to get information out to parents so they understand that when their OB says this, for them to say, so why do you make that recommendation? Is there some reason why VBAC is contraindicated to me? And we have an entire podcast episode on VBAC myths because there are a lot of myths. Women are often told that their baby is too big to plan a VBAC, which is almost always not the case. They're told that they can't plan a VBAC after 40 weeks gestation. That's not the case. They're told that maybe they have a single layer suture and therefore they're not a candidate for VBAC. That's also false. I mean, I could go on and on, but there's a lot of misinformation. And so for parents to have access to that quality information and also for practitioners, and that's why we became a nursing continuing education provider, because I want practitioners to have access to quality information. And there is so much misinformation that is unfortunately conveyed by physicians and midwives and nurses that there is an incredible opportunity for improvement there. So that's another area we can improve. And also hospital VBAC access. It's very difficult to find nationwide current statistics on VBAC access in hospitals. We have studies that look at regional access, maybe access by county in a particular area, or maybe even at state level. But overwhelmingly, when we look at the national VBAC rate in the U.S., which as I said, hovers around 15%, we can see that 85% of people have a repeat cesarean. And so clearly, there is more work to be done. And part of that is ensuring that hospitals, as well as parents, understand that U.S. national VBAC guidelines state that all level one hospitals in the U.S., as defined as those that can offer basic care, can offer VBAC. Right now, we have a lot of rural facilities that say, well, we can't offer VBAC because ACOG, the American College of OBGYN, says that we need to have XYZ. We need to have 24/7 anesthesia. We need to have a NICU. We need to have a blood bank. And of course, all of these things would be wonderful to have, but ACOG is very clear that in the absence of those services, that does not mean that repeat cesareans should be required. That decision to offer to have a VBAC still lies with the patient. And in rural facilities, they say, well, what would we do if someone needs an emergency C-section? And the answer is, you do exactly what you would do if a first-time parent required an emergency C-section. Those same protocols and policies that you have in place, those same emergencies that your team has been practicing for and running drills for, those are the same things that would happen. No special care or special staffing or resources is required in order to offer VBAC. So those are, again, clarification on misinformation that we often see in the U.S. that inhibits access to VBAC.
And you mentioned the access to VBAC in hospitals, and then there is this out-of-hospital setting. I'm not 100% sure on that, but I think that some states in the United States don't even allow midwives to attend a home VBAC. Is that correct?
That's correct. I mean, yes, exactly. And that's an example of the kind of laws and rules that I work with advocates to change on the state level. And you're absolutely right. There are states that say midwives cannot attend VBAC. And so that creates a very special challenge for parents who live in a state where maybe there's only a couple counties in their state that have a physician. Maybe those physicians don't even offer VBAC. Okay, what do they do now? There was actually a study that was released in early 2025 that found that only 16% of U.S. counties offered VBAC, 1/6. So when we think of how few counties actually have access to VBAC, and then we have rules and laws that say, midwife, you can't offer VBAC. We are further restricting VBAC access, which fundamentally what that means is we have more and more people having repeat cesareans, which carry a higher risk of maternal mortality, a 5 times higher risk of maternal mortality, as well as increased complications, not only in that delivery, but in future pregnancies. and lifelong health implications long after that person is done having children. So a C-section is a welcomed and celebrated surgery when there is a medical reason for that surgery to proceed, or when the mother says, you know what, I want a C-section. Great. But when the woman doesn't want a C-section, or when there is no medical reason for that C-section to occur, then that is a time where really vaginal birth should be prioritized, and women should have the opportunity to make that choice. But time and time again in the U.S., we see that's not the case. And in fact, I just had an obstetrician leave a comment on our social media page a few days ago saying, you know, you shouldn't bash doctors. We're all on this team together. I'm a doctor who attends VBAC. It's very important to me. And I replied to her, thank you. We need more doctors like you. There are wonderful doctors out there like you. However, the overwhelming majority recommend a repeat cesarean for most or all patients in their practice. That's not a judgment, good or bad. That is a statement of truth. And we see that through the national statistics we have in the U.S. We see that in medical research, which looks at physician preferences, attitudes, fears regarding VBAC. And we see that in the lived experiences of parents who come and share their stories, hundreds of thousands of stories that I hold in my heart of women who say, this was never an option for me. So this isn't about bashing doctors. This is about being clear about where are the barriers to VBAC access, because only by clearly identifying those barriers can we actually say, okay, now this is where we need to approach. These are the things we need to address.
Absolutely. And we've talked about that throughout now, that there are these different areas. There are the parents, there are the care providers, but then there are also the lawmakers and the policymakers, which I found really relieving when I found your website and you were addressing these two groups. I was like, okay, finally someone is talking about that. Because I think most people, and I mean me included, like probably like 6 years ago before I had my first son, I thought of birth as something that, you know, parents should know about and the care providers, but I didn't think of it in a broader context of laws and culture and society. So can you talk a little bit more about that, why it is so important to educate policymakers and why it's also important to educate lawmakers, and also, as you were saying, that you were assisting in court cases that concern VBAC?
Yeah, thank you for asking this question, because like you said, it's something that a lot of people don't think about, right? When we think about birth, we think about parents, of course, and the care providers. But unfortunately, with VBAC, there's a larger issue at play. And so when we talk about policymakers, you know, policymakers are like any other human being, right? There might be individual areas of interest that they know a lot about, and then there's everything else. Right. And so when a policymaker is asked to vote on a particular law or to create or advise on rules that are created and how the framework for those rules, how to develop that framework. So these policymakers, most of the time, do not know anything about birth, about childbirth, vaginal birth, C-sections, obstetrician, midwives. They often are a blank slate. So and in the U.S., we have major organizations like ACOG, the American College of OBGYNs, and the American Medical Association, who really represent the interests of physicians. Now, they state they represent the interests of the public, but that's really not the case, because if they represented the interests of the public, they would be doing things to ensure that birth was as safe as possible for all people in all settings. And rather, what they do is they spend a lot of time and money influencing midwifery laws in various states. And what does that look like? That can look like something like saying, well, a midwife can practice in a particular state, but she needs to have a collaborating physician. And that's basically a physician who looks over the midwife, who's ultimately responsible for the midwife. At least that's how the physician feels, which is why these laws are so problematic, right? Because no one wants to feel responsible for the actions of another person. And so ACOG and AMA put forward these rules and laws as a way to, in their mind maybe, make midwifery as safe as possible. But what ultimately happens is when midwives go around and try to find a collaborating physician, physicians don't want to collaborate with them, with very few exceptions. So what does that ultimately do? That means that midwives cannot legally practice in that state. That is a huge problem. Also, other things like mandatory transfer agreements, saying that midwives can only practice within a certain mile radius of a hospital. I mean, there's a variety of different ways that these rules and laws are created under the guise of patient safety. But the end result is it really ties the hands of midwives and makes it very difficult, if not impossible, for them to practice. And what I believe is that any professional's ability to practice should not be tied to another profession. Here's an example. You know, in the U.S., we have OBs who are obstetricians, right? Then we have maternal fetal medicine doctors. Those are high-risk OBs. They're also called perinatologists. We don't, in law, say, okay, an OB can attend a woman's care as long as that woman does not experience this list of complications. If she experiences this list of complications, now that OB needs to refer out to that maternal fetal medicine doctor. We don't have that written in law. Why? Because we trust OBs as a profession to sit there and say, you know what, your care, your health condition has now reached outside of my scope, my area of expertise, and I really think we need to get someone else's opinion who is a specialist on your care. And that person is referred out for either a consultation with an MFM, whatever happens from that point. Midwives are different. What they try to do is they try to say in midwifery law, if a woman experiences XYZ condition, she needs to go consult with an OB. So this is a problem for a variety of reasons. One, a lot of OBs don't understand midwives. They don't understand midwifery education. They don't understand why anyone would plan a home birth. They have very strong opinions about the option of home birth and women who choose home birth. And so to now say these women now have to consult with this group of professionals, who the bulk of which hold these attitudes about midwives, home births, and those who plan home birth, that puts that person in a very precarious position. Because now she's basically being put in a position to have the OB say, well, yeah, you're fine to plan a home birth. What OB would say that? So that's the other issue with this law. Not only does it compromise and insult the intelligence, the skills, the education of midwives, but now we also put OBs in this impossible position to say, oh yeah, you're totally fine to continue planning a home birth. OBs don't want to say that either. So that's another example of another type of another factor in these laws that tie the hands of midwives, harm access to care for patients, and also put OBs in this very precarious position of being able to say for certain what's going to happen in the future, which no one can do. So when I come into the room and I work with advocates on rules and laws, what I bring is I bring this incredible depth of knowledge that I've accumulated over the past 20 years, coupled with the lived experience of hundreds of thousands of parents, midwives, physicians, administrators, and be able to bring that into the laws. Because like I said, they often tie the hands of midwives. They harm patients and also put many OBs in this very awkward position of having to advise on something that they can't do. And then when we talk about the court, often expert witnesses are brought in. They're often OBs. They often hold these same cultural, social, legal concerns about VBAC, and that colors the testimony that they give. The testimony that the judge hears, maybe there's a jury, they hear it too. Maybe there's attorneys, they hear it too. And just like lawmakers, all of these people have areas that they know a lot about, in this case, the law. Then they have topics which they may not know a whole lot about, which is why they bring in expert witnesses. But if these expert witnesses simply convey and communicate the biases that we see in the U.S. medical system, and they convey that as the truth, then we have a problem. Because again, often the judge, the attorneys, the juries, the people in the courtroom are all blank slate. Many of them don't know anything about VBAC other than the idea of once a C-section, always a C-section. So when we bring these expert witnesses in and they convey the biases and the misinformation that we often see in the U.S. health system as truth, that further it harms the whole process, right? Because all of these parties, the judge, jury, and the attorneys, are not hearing often what the medical evidence says. They're not hearing what the medical ethics dictate. They're not truly educated on the concept of informed consent and what does that look like. And so when I come in as an expert witness, I'm bringing, again, that 20 years of experience, this incredibly encyclopedic knowledge of the medical evidence on VBAC, looking at U.S. national guidelines, and also comparing, contrasting, how does that compare to other countries around the world that are similarly resourced? So that way, the judge can really understand, what does it mean when someone chooses a VBAC? This isn't something that happens in a bubble. This is something that happens within this larger social, cultural, political, legal, huge factor in the U.S., framework. And so when we have things like physicians being afraid of being sued if something goes wrong during a VBAC, we know from the research, we know from physician case studies, we know from the lived experience of patients, that influences care. And so I love working on policy and I love working on legal cases because that has the opportunity to really change how laws and rules are created and how individual cases are reviewed and ultimately judged. Because then not only does that make an impact in that individual situation, but that judge, that lawmaker, that attorney now carries that additional new information with them and can dip back into that when they encounter another case or another piece of legislation that addresses VBAC.
Thank you for your work. It's all I can say to that. I mean, I'm so moved and I wish we had more people like you over here in Europe. And especially I live in Austria and I don't know if you're aware of that. We have a case against a midwife at the moment. She attended a home birth after cesarean and the baby unfortunately passed away. The baby wasn't born at home. The midwife transferred to hospital. The baby was born at the hospital and died at the hospital. And yet it is the midwife who is being accused of causing the death of the baby by gross negligence. And I mean, we're hopeful at the moment. She was convicted. She appealed. The conviction's overturned. Now we're waiting for a retrial. But I just see that there are not many people here in Austria or in Germany or in Switzerland and the German-speaking countries that speak about the importance of legislation when it comes to VBAC in the way that you just did. And that was one reason why I wanted you to come on my podcast so you can maybe, I think, so there are many people that want to create change, but I think often they don't know how to. So what would you say to them? Like, where do we start in bringing about the change that we want?
Yeah. Well, in the U.S., I don't know how your political structures work in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland. But in the U.S., I can give you some tips based on how things work here, and maybe there'll be some parallels. So what I recommend in the U.S. is for people to find other like-minded people. Sometimes that is a state-level midwifery organization. Sometimes that is a doula organization. Just get together with like-minded people and decide what it is you want to change and then go start meeting with legislators. Talk to your local legislator. Go to them and say, hey, were you aware that, and say there's a piece of legislation, a law in place that limits midwifery access. So you can go to these legislators and say, hey, are you aware that this law is in place? You know, I am a parent. I hired a midwife or I wanted to hire a midwife. Go share your story, create a connection, share high quality information so they understand, like, what difference does it make if midwives are available in your state or not? Oh, people are actually interested in hiring a midwife. I had no idea. You know, often, as I said, these legislators, they simply don't know. And by you making an appointment with them and going and meeting with them, and maybe you and like two other parents go and you just talk about, or you and two other midwives or two other doulas, and just go and make that personal connection and share your story. And then you can start thinking about how do you want to change that legislation, get that new bill written, and find a legislator who is willing to sponsor your bill and introduce your bill. These are all process. I mean, this is a more lengthy process, but that's like the major steps for creating change. And it can take a very long time. It can take years. And this is why it is so important to not get discouraged, to keep on going, to keep on working, and to really foster those relationships, because you do need that legislator to sponsor your legislation. And so to create that personal relationship and nurture it, so that way when the time comes and you find that midwifery advocate in legislation, you're able to say, hey, I have this new law. It can really solve problem XYZ. Here are the benefits that it will create. And just take it one step at a time and just keep on going. In general, I don't know the specifics of this case that you're referring to, but one thing that we see in the U.S. is that when midwives are involved with a fetal death, it is often tried as a criminal case. But we don't see that with obstetricians. And so that is one of the major differences that we see in how midwives are treated in the U.S. versus obstetricians. And of course, it's incredibly problematic.
Yeah, it's very similar here. It's rare that an obstetrician is tried criminally. And I think the public perception of this case is that the parents sued the midwife, but it wasn't the parents, it was the state. Mm. And the parents are still in support of the midwife.
That is so frustrating when, and again, I don't know the facts of the case, but I have seen similar cases where parents make an informed decision about planning an out-of-hospital birth with a midwife, and something goes wrong. And the state, not the parents, but the state has come in to punish the midwife. And again, this is a reflection of a misunderstanding about who midwives are, why people plan out of hospital birth, and most importantly, the concept of informed consent. The state who brings this case clearly doesn't understand these concepts, because informed consent fundamentally means that you understand the risks and benefits at play. And you say, this is the choice that I want to make, because every single choice that we make in life, especially medical choices, they all have been looking at two or three different options, which hold very different benefits and risks. And what is compelling to an individual person, why someone would choose option A, B, or C, depends on a variety of very personal factors. And I might choose option A, and you might choose option B. And that's not because one is right and one is wrong. It's just you and I might have different things that are important to us. And that's okay. The choices that we have around birth are morally neutral. There is no judgment about if you are right or wrong to plan a vaginal birth versus a C-section at a hospital, at your home, in a birth center. There are no right or wrong choices here. There are just different risks, which is why informed consent and having access to accurate information is so important. Because when someone thinks, oh, there's no risk with this, that's where we have a problem, is when they don't truly understand what the risks are.
Absolutely. And I love that concept that there is no... Now I'm just like, how do you say it? There's the morality of it. There's no...
Yeah, morally neutral. More, and I actually got that phrase from Casey, I think this is her name, Casey Davis. She wrote an excellent book called How to Clean the House While Drowning. And she talks about how, completely off topic to birth, but I just wanted to credit her with this concept, because she talks about how whether your house is messy or not is morally neutral. And I love that idea, because there is so much judgment about people who have a messy home. Right. And she just says, hey, this is a morally neutral thing. And when I read her book, I really thought about the same about birth, because there is so much judgment also about how women birth, where they birth, and who attends their birth. And to get away from this idea of, well, this is the right way, this is the wrong way, you're a bad mother, you're a good mother, you succeeded, you failed. Instead of all of that, just realize all of this is morally neutral. And it just really releases a lot when you can just really say, like, this is not a moral decision. This is just the decision that I have made based on the risks and benefits ahead of me, the variety of personal factors that influence this decision. I mean, just one example, say someone wants two or three more children. Well, if they want two or three more children, a vaginal birth might be the safer route for them. because as we have more and more C-sections, the risks increase. So that's just one example. Maybe someone had a C-section, they're having their second child, and they say, you know what? I want to be sterilized. I don't want any more children. And fine, you know, I mean, that might be what drives that decision. But another person, same background, just one prior cesarean, but they might say, you know what? I really want two or three more children. Do I really want two or three more C-sections? No, I don't. So I really want to have a VBAC. Neither of those choices or those scenarios are morally wrong. It's just two people, two different scenarios, two different decisions, and two different births to celebrate.
Is there anything else you would like to share with my listeners regarding VBACs?
Well, if you'd like to learn more, go to VBACfacts.com. I have a variety of articles up on the website. We also have a podcast that is currently on hiatus, but I do intend to bring it back at some point. As I said, we also have our courses for parents and professionals, and I do offer that legal and policy consulting. And I want to share, in terms of, I get a lot of questions from people who live outside of the U.S. asking if our online programs are relevant to people who live in other countries outside of the U.S. And I would say absolutely yes. I do focus a lot on American VBAC guidelines, but as I have reviewed VBAC guidelines for a variety of other countries, including throughout Europe, I see that there are a lot of similarities. There are some small differences, but there are a lot of similarities, and those research. And so that's the other thing that I go through in the course, is talking a lot about what does the research say? And that is relevant regardless of what country you're in. So if you are someone outside of the U.S. and you want to learn more about VBAC, come check out our resources for parents and professionals, because I think you'll find that you will significantly deepen your knowledge, increase your confidence, which of course, whether you are a parent or a professional, will mitigate the fear or trepidation that you feel about VBAC. And especially if you're a professional, that is going to improve care.
Wonderful. I'll put all of your links in the show notes. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Absolutely a pleasure being with you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this interview, then please share it with a friend or a family member. And you could also leave me a review in your podcast app, which is highly appreciated because it supports my work and helps me to be shown to more people in the podcast apps. So thank you, and until next time.